Should teachers in Florida get a raise? Good morning and happy President's Day. Thanks for being with us this Monday on First Coast Connect. I'm Melissa Ross. Hope you're enjoying whatever you're up to this morning. Hopefully some lighter traffic out there as kids and teachers are off from school. And just ahead, a look at the fight for better teacher pay in Florida. What do you think about that? Give us a call, especially if you're a teacher. 549-2937 to join us. Then later, we'll take a listen to WJCT's new podcast, What It's Like. Plus, Cole Pepper on the wild finish over the weekend at the Daytona 500. All of that and more ahead this morning. But first this hour, the crisis over teacher pay in Florida. The Sunshine State is ranked 42nd out of 50 states in medium teacher income. Now, to pay the bills, the teachers that educate your children often work a full-time job, but then also moonlight. They proctor exams. They drive for Uber. They teach English as a second language. They bartend. Sometimes they work construction or at Publix. Whatever they have to do to make ends meet. Here's the problem, though. All over Florida, underpaid, overworked teachers have had enough, and they're quitting the classroom. And fewer college graduates are deciding to become teachers. So there's a shortage of qualified teachers in the pipeline. Against this backdrop, new Governor Ron DeSantis recently proposed a teacher bonus program. Now, DeSantis says he wants to ask the legislature to put $422 million into a program that would provide the best and brightest teachers in Florida a one-time bonus of about $9,000. So how do teachers in the Sunshine State feel about that? Well, it's President's Day, and most teachers around town are off, so we decided to ask one. It's Chris Guerreri, a Jacksonville teacher in his 18th year in the classroom. He also runs a widely read education blog called Jack's Kids Matter. Chris Guerreri joins us now in Studio 5. Good morning.
Good morning, and thanks for having me.
Thanks for being with us. And here's our question to callers. Do you think Florida's teachers should get a raise? What do you think of the governor's proposal to pay teachers bonuses? Give us a call, 549-2937. That's 549-2937. Or go online, send your emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org, tweets to @MelissaInJax, and let us know your thoughts on our Facebook page as well. Okay, Chris Guerreri, we just saw the resolution of a big teacher strike in Denver, Colorado. Teachers out there striking for better pay. There was another recent teacher strike in California. There have been teachers walking off the job in Oklahoma, West Virginia, all over the country. Teachers are crying out and saying, we cannot afford to do this anymore. And the story is much the same in Florida, where we're ranked 42nd out of 50 states in the U.S. for median teacher income. I want to begin by asking you, as a veteran teacher and blogger in Jacksonville, what do you think of the governor's proposal giving teachers in Florida a one-time bonus of $9,000?
Well, first of all, it's not all teachers. It's only 45,000, which is about 25%, maybe a little less than 25% of all teachers. And they have to be highly effective. And they have to be highly effective with some caveats. They have to move their school. Their school has to move by 1%. So if you're at a magnet school that's already at the top of the game, you're not going to be eligible for that money. Or if you're at a center school where that doesn't get grades because you work with disabled children, you're not going to be eligible for that money. You know, it sounds great when you just hear $9,000 for teachers, but the devil's in the details. And his details exclude a lot of teachers. Just to give you a little bit of an example, I'm on step 16. It's my 18th year in the classroom, but 1 year I was a sub, and 1 year they didn't give out steps. A step 16 teacher in 2006.
What does that mean, step?
Each year you teach, you get a step, and that determines your pay.
Okay. So it's like a raise?
Right. Like a modest raise. Well, in steps, a step 16 teacher in 2006, before the financial crisis, had $5,000 more in buying power than I have now. That's money that I'll never be able to make up. Florida's done an okay job with starting teacher salary, but it's done it at the expense of veteran teachers who are making a lot less now than what they would have made before the Great Recession.
And that's something I know teachers advocates have talked a lot about. We've long been out of the recession, but teachers haven't seen any kind of increase. They're calling for a regular salary increase rather than a one-time bonus. And they also want extended contracts of more than a single year so that they could apply, say, for home mortgages.
Right.
Basically, your profession is saying we want to professionalize the teaching profession. We're doing a professional job, but we aren't getting professional pay. Is that right?
That's right. And we could just go back 10 years or 12 years before the Great Recession when Florida treated teachers like professionals. But since then, Florida has really been attacking teachers. They've been attacking the teaching profession and doing all they can to whittle it down.
And how do you feel that that is shaping up, not just in terms of pay, but also the other big complaint I think teachers have, and so do so many parents, is state-mandated testing imperatives?
Right. The FBA, the Florida Education Association, just did an article that said we have 2,200 teacher openings right now compared to 700 last year. And teachers have been forced to teach to the test, destroying creativity, destroying flexibility. It determines their salary if they get to keep their job. Can you imagine being at the end of the year, you could be fired for any or no reason, even if you've done a great job? I read an article last year that said something like 700 effective teachers, teachers determined to be effective by their schools, had been let go.
Why?
No reason needs to be given. The system is set up that teachers are just easily replaceable cogs. But we're learning now that that's not the case, because we don't just have a looming teacher shortage. We have a crisis, a teacher crisis right now.
And the crisis is, it seems to me, the crisis is that so many teachers are just quitting. They're working two or three jobs just to pay the bills. Mm-hmm. And then they finally say, you know what, I've had enough. I'm not going to do this anymore. The average tenure of a teacher in Florida is 5 years. Mm-hmm. And you have long argued on your blog, Jack's Kids Matter, that kids need veteran teachers in the classroom to really get the full benefit of a great teacher. But teachers increasingly in the environment of low pay, the testing standards, the demonization, I think, of their profession in some ways, have just said, no, we're not going to do this. So all over the state now, what we're seeing, and I believe here in Duval County and St. John's and Nassau too, are classroom vacancies. This is sort of an invisible protest. Teachers are walking away. That is putting the burden on increasingly substitute teachers, and it's spreading the class load around to the teachers that remain. And so is this something, let me ask you, as someone who's taught for almost 20 years, are you thinking of quitting?
Well, if I knew now what I knew 20 years ago when I started the job, I don't know if I would have taken the job. Also, I was offered a job at a local bank making twice the amount of money that I was then. But, you know, I loved teaching. And it used to be that if you taught for so long, you would get that big bump. You would get that workable salary. That's not how it is now. You mentioned Denver just a few minutes ago. Denver struck, and they struck for a pay scale like we used to have, where for years of experience, you would get a higher and higher salary. And then once you hit 5 years and 10 years, you'd get like a sizable bump. That's how we used to do it. But that's not how we do it anymore.
Back in the days of former Governor Bob Graham in Florida, teachers got basically an 8.5% raise every year over part of his tenure. That was the last time, according to former teachers in Florida, that teachers got decent raises. The legislature in 2011 froze teacher pay in the wake of the financial crisis and ended a number of veteran teacher benefits. For some time now, teachers have been on one-year contracts, makes it harder to get mortgages and conduct other business. And so, as you pointed out, Chris, teachers in Colorado went on strike for some of these same issues. Teachers in L.A. recently did a big teacher strike, too, that was finally mediated and settled. Now, here in Florida, I think it's a different picture because I believe that it is illegal for teachers in Florida to strike.
Teachers can lose their jobs and lose their pensions.
Okay. So given that teachers cannot go on strike for better pay, increasingly they're just leaving. So let me ask you, in addition to this matter of pay, how you see Governor DeSantis addressing this, because on a number of educational issues, he has departed from his predecessor, Rick Scott. He's saying, I'm hearing all over the state from parents that the testing standards are a problem, that there's too much of an emphasis on testing, that teachers aren't being paid enough. So he's tossed out the Common Core education standards. We don't know what he's going to replace them with. He's calling for the one-time bonus program. And on Friday, the governor also made an announcement for equal opportunity scholarships. Now, these are scholarships that traditional public school advocates say would harm the traditional public schools in favor of vouchers and charter and private schools. DeSantis disagreed, saying any school that gets taxpayer money, in my opinion, is a public school. So how do you see DeSantis handling education issues as opposed to Rick Scott?
I think DeSantis is out making a lot of statements and because he wants his base to feel good. But what if you look at the details of what he's offering, he's not offering much. He offered a $236 increase to the per pupil spending. But if he wanted to go back to 2006 levels, he'd have to offer an $1,800 increase to per pupil spending. And so we're going to get about $7,500 per kid. But what we really should be getting is about $9,100 per student just to meet 2006 levels. As far as the scholarship program, isn't he just saying accountability doesn't matter? We talk about testing and how much we test here in the state, but private schools don't have to give the test. But now he's saying, well, let's give more scholarships to private schools that don't have to offer the test. So how does that make any sense that public schools have to be tied to the test, have their futures tied to the test, when private schools that also take public money can do whatever they want? And another thing about private schools that take vouchers, their teachers don't have to be certified. They don't have to have degrees. The Orlando Sentinel did a piece where many teach junk science and junk history. Like if you're a slave and you had Jesus in your heart, you were free, and that people live with dinosaurs. These are actual
curriculums. You're talking about parochial schools, right, that receive taxpayer money.
That are
money.
Being funded Some of them, yeah. by taxpayer money. If there is no standards for private school, why has the accountability been ratcheted up to 11 for public schools? Why do only public schools have to face these extreme measures?
It's 549-2937. Give us a call on this President's Day as we talk about the teacher pay crisis in Florida. So many teachers leaving the profession altogether. If you're a teacher who's off today, you can give us a call too. 549-2937. Meanwhile, lots of emails and tweets coming into the show. Here's one on Twitter. A listener writes, Governor DeSantis's teacher bonus program is actually a shell game. It shifts money into temporary opportunities instead of long-term wage increases. It's just another effort to treat essential public services as private entities. Bonuses, he says, won't attract the best and brightest. What about the argument, the pushback to that argument, though, Chris, that DeSantis knows calling for across-the-board teacher pay increases isn't going to pass this legislature? Perhaps he's, you know, putting forth what he thinks might have a chance of passing.
Why wouldn't it pass the legislature? Don't our legislators believe in public education? Don't they support public schools? Don't they support teachers? I mean, I think that's what it comes down to. A lot of our legislators in Tallahassee, they don't believe in public education. They don't want to support public education. There's no guarantee his bonus proposal will pass either. We have some issues in public education. I can't say that we don't. But a lot of those issues were created by the people that want to privatize and replace public education, like our legislators in Tallahassee. Richard Corcoran, our new department, Commissioner of Education, his wife runs charter schools. Manny Diaz, our Senate person in charge of education, he works for a college that runs charter schools that siphons those money into his schools. We have people in charge of education that want to replace public education, and it's a shame.
Do you now, whenever we've talked about this on this program, traditional public school advocates such as yourself have made that allegation. They've said, the pro-privatization movement wants to dismantle public education in Florida. The school choice movement, people that speak for it and are prominent players, they dispute that. They say, we are simply trying to provide choice and competition to better improve education outcomes for everybody. And so what's your response to that?
Well, choice and competition. Do we have choice and competition with our police department? Or our fire department, or with our meat inspectors? No, we don't have that at all. What we do is we have a high quality option. And when we take that away, resources from that high quality option, it diminishes that option. And a thing about charter schools, I don't know if your listening audience knows, but over 330 have failed in Florida. That's taken public money and left neighborhoods in lurch. And charter schools were supposed to be innovative so they could bring that innovation back to the public schools. What innovation do many charter schools have? The answer is none. And many are for profit.
So you don't think any of the higher performing charter schools in the state are innovating? Like, for example, I'll give you one example. I know you've blogged about it at Jack's Kids Matter. The KIPP schools in Jacksonville, you don't see them as innovating.
Well, the KIPP school, their innovation is by having a longer school year and a longer school day. Now, some people like me think some of our kids do need a longer school year and a longer school day because it takes them longer to get it and they need less time so they don't forget it. But the thing is, when you look at the KIPP school, they spend about a third more than the public schools do per student. And their grades have been up and down like a yo-yo. I submit that if you gave a public school a third more resources, they would blow KIPP out of the water.
Let's go to lots of calls now as we talk about education on this President's Day. That's why local teacher and blogger Chris Guerrieri was able to come in today, because teachers are off. We want to hear from you out there, teachers, and anyone who has an interest in Florida schools. 549-2937. Jessica is in Town Center. Hi, Jessica. Good morning.
Hi. Can you hear me okay?
Yes, go ahead.
So I had the fortunate experience to take a workshop with Martha Menno, Dean of Harvard Law School, and her focus is on educational policy. When she found out I was from Duval County, she went on about a five-minute rant about how they know all about Duval County and its horrible performance. And it's in a lot of educational research literature because of its size. The district is one of the biggest in the country. And, you know, this, I think it's abhorrent, the amount of money we pay teachers. I have several friends who are in the profession. They make $40,000 a year or less, despite teaching for almost a decade. They all have to have second jobs. When I was in public high school here, many of my teachers had to have second jobs as waiters at Olive Garden. This is one of the main reasons that most of my generation, the millennial workforce, leave this city, because they do not feel like they can start families here and trust that they will have quality public education, or affordable public education for that matter. So I just wanted to, you know, put that forth to any city fathers that happen to listen to your show, as I know they do. This is a critical, urgent issue if you want to retain good workforce members here, and if you want to attract companies that need those high-quality workforce members here. They want good public education.
Thanks, Jessica. Thanks for that. And Chris Guerrieri, the cost of living in Florida is 16th out of 50 states, but we are ranked 42nd for median teacher pay. And so, as Jessica pointed out, that leads to a lot of bright, talented people not only leaving the classroom, but maybe leaving Florida to teach somewhere else.
Well, we definitely have a teacher pay problem that we need to address. Like I said before, we have 2,600 openings statewide, up from 700 last year. If we don't address this, it's just going to get worse. And I don't understand how our leaders in Tallahassee don't understand that. And bonuses are not going to attract teachers. Teachers being on a one-year contract is not going to attract people to the profession.
So you don't think the $9,000 bonus will be welcomed by
teachers? No, absolutely not. People do not want a bonus. They want a raise. And like I said before, it's for less than 25% of the teachers.
And well, how will they choose who receives the bonuses?
Well, it's based on a highly effective evaluation.
Okay.
Now, the thing about highly effective evaluation is there are 67 districts, and they evaluate how you're highly effective 67 different ways. In Clay County, 95% of their teachers are highly effective. In Duval, it's just 33%.
Well, and as we've talked about on this program many times, a lot of that is due to factors outside the classroom,
right,
socioeconomic determinants, poverty, high crime neighborhoods. By the way, we had a rash of violent crime over the weekend in Jacksonville once again. Lots going on with that. But let's go to lots of calls now for teacher and blogger Chris Guerrieri. Greg is in Jacks Beach. Hi, Greg. Good morning. How are you?
Good morning. How are you?
Okay, thanks. Go ahead.
Well, I've got two quick questions. The first one, the lottery. How does that come into play with our teachers? Now, that's supposed to be a big boon for our teachers, their pay and education. And my second question, and I'll hang up and listen to your response after this, is 25% of the teacher's time they're getting paid for is basically like a paid vacation during the summer. How does that come into play with their salaries?
Okay, thanks for those questions. That's Greg out at the beach. Chris.
Well, first, the lottery is a myth. P- people should stop thinking the lottery helps public education. Maybe 20 years ago, maybe 25 years ago it did, but now it doesn't. It plays absolutely no role in what's going on in your schools.
Money's allocated, though, right?
The last figure I saw was $19,000 was given to the general budget here in Jacksonville. $19,000 from the lodge.
Where'd you get that figure?
From at a workshop that DCPS put on. A lot of the lotto money now goes to scholarships for kids to go to college. Now, as for teachers getting paid 25% of their salary over the summer, that's mistaken. Teachers aren't paid over the summer. We don't get paid over the summer. Now, we can set up a process where we take money out of our weekly salary during the year to give us that money over the summer, but we're not paid over the summer.
And do you work a second job?
No, I don't work a second job right now, but I have worked at camps before. And I'm married, and my wife makes a pretty good amount of money. But if I were a single person, I couldn't do it.
Teachers do all over the state work a number of second gigs.
I know lots of teachers at my school that work in the team up program or bus tables or work in waitress jobs.
Yeah, the average teacher pay around the state, the median pay is in the mid 40s, but then teachers at the lower end of the scale are making in the 30s, correct?
Well, it depends on the district.
It depends on the county. Okay.
Right. A lot of the smaller districts, they can't afford to pay anything. So that's what they're getting by on that amount of salary.
All right, let's go to Mark in St. Augustine. Hi, Mark. Good morning.
Hey, good morning. I just want to make a comment, I guess, and get your guest's opinion on this. I believe that teachers ought to have more authority and disciplinary ability in the classroom to not only fail students who aren't performing, but also to discipline those who are, you know, disruptive to their class. I know firsthand in St. John's County, some teachers down there, I think being a teacher is a very noble profession, but I know some teachers down there almost feel that their hands are tied with the grades that they are, quote unquote, forced to give their students. And the result is that at the superintendent level, they're able to pat themselves on the back and say, hey, we have an A-rated school down here, when in essence, all you're doing is passing along a child who's not performing at his or her level. And if you doubt that that happens, why then do we have all these remedial courses in college to try and bring kids up to a collegiate level of education? So sure. I wish that they would allow the teachers to have more of that authority in their own classroom.
Thank you for that, Mark.
Well, I think discipline is a topic we could have a week's worth of shows on.
Right. We're talking pay today, but that is another issue.
We really, really could. As for grade inflation, sure, it goes on. What are you going to do if your principal comes to you and goes, well, if you don't have this many people graduate or this many grades, you're not going to have a job next year? The system is set up like a game. You have to promote so many kids. You have to give so many grades. And it's sad because it kind of diminishes what public education should be about.
Amy is on the line at the beaches. Amy is a teacher. Hi, Amy. Where do you teach? Good morning.
Hi. Thank you for letting me share. This is my 19th year in education. I moved from the north, took a $10,000 pay cut. I make $50,000 a year. I test 2 months of the 9 months I teach. I test. And I also have to save my money during the 9 months I teach to afford living over the summer.
Right.
So that's the situation today. And it's not just the state testing, it's the district testing.
And so what do you think of the Governor DeSantis saying we need less of an emphasis on testing and also calling for teacher bonuses and also throwing out the Common Core education testing standards?
Well, I absolutely believe we need less testing. That is for sure. But the testing correlates with our pay, our VAM score. So every class, every content has to have a pre and a post test. So that's part of the reason we test so much. Plus the district does mock testing all year long. The bonus, the one-time bonus is a fluke, highly effective. Yes, some of that attributes to the actual scores. Half of that's your scores that your children make. But half of that is based on administration evaluation, and there's a lot of bias in that.
Okay, Amy, thanks for that. And so let me just read a couple of tweets before we go to break. Here's one from Travis. I'm afraid by issuing bonuses, they will just become a one-time payment. Educators need a permanent increase in salary. We need to pay them competitively and well enough to attract out-of-state talent as well. Brian tweets the show, a temporary bonus is great for getting a temporary teacher. What if we want career teachers? Which brings me to something I want to quickly mention. For career educators, anyone in the classroom, we invite you to come to WJCT's 6th annual Teach Conference. That's an event created to engage, empower, and inspire teachers. This is coming up March 2nd at the Hyatt Hotel in downtown Jacksonville. This is a full day of engagement and sessions for teachers. Go to wjct.org/teach to register. And Chris Guerreri, this is just the beginning of more conversations about this, but I invite everyone to check out your blog, Jack's Kids Matter, for more about the teaching profession.
Well, thank you for having me. And I just want to say that there are a lot of wonderful things going on in Duval County, and I think we shouldn't lose sight of that. We have an amazing teacher corps, and we have a lot of great kids. But there are issues, and I think a lot of those issues are created by Tallahassee because they want to privatize and replace public education.
Thanks, Chris. Still to come, Cole Pepper on a wild finish at Daytona, and our new podcast, What It's Like. Also, the conflicts over science education in Florida, too. That's after this. This is First Coast Connect on 89.9. We'll be right back. Welcome back. Well, a bill was recently filed in Tallahassee that would require Florida schools teach alternatives to climate science and evolution. Tonight, Brandon Hodd of the group Florida Citizens for Science is speaking about that in Jacksonville. His talk is titled A War That Won't End, The Battle for Science Education in the Sunshine State. I spoke with Hodd about why he says science is under attack in our state classrooms. Take a listen. Brandon Hodd, thanks for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Let me begin, before we get into the larger issues around this, by getting your reaction, first off, to a bill that is returning to be considered in the Florida Senate in the upcoming legislative session. It's drawn a lot of criticism, in particular, because it proposes teaching alternative theories to both climate change and evolution. Tell me a little bit more about this legislation and why you're concerned about it.
Yes, this legislation addresses all academic standards in that it allows school districts, if they so choose, to pick their own set of standards, whether they make their own or adopt them from someplace else, as long as they consider them to be as rigorous or more rigorous than the state academic standards. The first problem we have, of course, is that there is no definition in the bill for the word rigorous. Everyone would have their own opinion as to what is more rigorous than what we currently have in Florida. Now, of course, the issue that draws my attention, I am a representative of an organization called Florida Citizens for Science. And so, of course, our concern is with science. And what we're worried about is that it specifically says in this bill, it targets science standards, saying that if you adopt some new standards, that you have to cover, quote, controversial theories or subjects in a fair, factual, and balanced manner. Now, in the bill, it doesn't say what those controversial theories are. And I, as a science teacher, I don't know what they are either. I mean, from just the plain language, what do you mean by controversial theories? What I teach in the classroom, according to science and scientists, the scientific field, that there are no controversial theories. But of course, we know what his meaning is, Senator Baxley. We know what his meaning is because he's come out against evolution and climate change many times over the past years. And so we know for a fact that is what he has in mind when he means controversial theories.
Okay, this has been introduced before, hasn't passed, hasn't even gotten out of the committee stage. But it's certainly a timely discussion point as you discuss just the larger battle over information in Florida classrooms when it comes to science. Your talk is called A War That Won't End, The Battle for Science Education in the Sunshine State. Judging by that, it sounds as though you feel that this is just a constant battle to get students taught accurate and scientific information in Florida.
Yeah, it's not even that I feel that way. It's that I know it's that way. I wrote a book published by the University Press of Florida called Going Ape, Florida's Battles Over Evolution in the Classroom, and it details the constant fight, the constant battle, the constant war that we've had over this topic of evolution in our Florida public schools. It started in the 1920s, and I think we might have had about one and a half decade off from the controversy, and that was back in like around the 1940s or so. But since then, every single decade, we've had multiple endless battles over this that have reached the statewide stage and even has gotten, you know, national attention. And so Senator Baxley's bill, whereas it didn't get any traction at all last year, there's always a chance it'll get traction this year. And the reason why I'm saying that is because we've already seen some fights over evolution just in the past couple of months. We do have a law now in Florida that allows any citizen at all, not just a parent, but any citizen, to approach their local school district and complain about what they feel are bad instructional materials, such as textbooks. And so some groups have taken advantage of that new law and have, in fact, gone in front of school boards protesting that climate change and evolution are in those textbooks. Now, we were really sweating it because there was actually close votes at these school districts, 3-2. Just one person changing their vote could have switched this all around the wrong way. But that proves to us that there is still this fight and that momentum could then push this current bill forward, unlike last year.
And explain, if you could, why that would be so calamitous for education in this state. Because as a scientist, you know, scientists don't look at scientific evidence and theories as, well, on the one hand this, but on the other hand that. The science is simply the science. You want fact-based education in the classroom, right?
That is absolutely correct. We are here in high school, we are building a foundation, and that foundation has to be solid and based on actual science. One problem is that we can confuse students as to what science is. He said, she said. No, that's not what science is. Science is based off the research and the facts that we've gathered so far. And so that's one issue, is making sure we build that strong foundation. Another issue is time. I teach environmental science. And one thing I teach about is climate change. But unfortunately, in my curriculum map, you know, what I have to follow to get me through the year, all the things I need to teach, climate change, as a devoted, dedicated subject, I only get about a week, maybe a little bit more than a week to teach it. And so in that time, I've got to teach them what greenhouse gases are, what the greenhouse effect is, and all sorts of things like that. You know, the very basic information that, quite frankly, they've come into my class not knowing yet. So I got to lay that foundation. Now with Senator Baxley's bill, now somehow I've got to shoehorn some other information in there. And the question is why? It's not science. And the other question is when? When do you expect me to shoehorn this into my curriculum?
So what is Florida Citizens for Science doing to lobby against this legislation?
Well, of course, we are making the public aware about it. You know, that's me going out and giving talks, doing interviews with media outlets like yours. And so that raises awareness that this is happening out there. Then once we raise that awareness and start getting more and more loud voices to then push back in the state legislature saying, wait a minute, we don't want this. This is a bad, bad idea. And, of course, we're also, you know, working with other organizations, Americans United for Church and States, for separation of church and state, I'm sorry. The League of Women Voters, you know, any other organization that feels the same way we do, teaming up with them to once again put pressure out there to say, no, this is an extremely bad idea.
Well, we appreciate you giving us a preview of your talk happening in Jacksonville. Brandon Haught, He is with Florida Citizens for Science, and he will be talking about these issues right here in our area. Brandon, thanks for being with us.
And once again, thank you.
You can hear Hotz talk tonight at 6:30 p.m. at the First Coast Freethought Society. They're at the Buckman Bridge Unitarian Universalist Church on Manresa Avenue in Jacksonville. And in a moment, we'll take a listen to What It's Like, our new podcast. Stay right there.
The Players' Championship moves to March. The drama unfolds on the Island Green March 12th through the 17th with the all-new Players' Welcome Experience, featuring the PGA Tour Fan Shop and a variety of local restaurants. Tickets and parking today at theplayers.com.
Florida Prepaid. For 30 years, Florida Prepaid has been helping Florida families save for college. Open enrollment is happening now with college plans for every budget. And prepaid plans are guaranteed by the state of Florida. Florida Prepaid. Starting is believing.
This is what teachers are saying about Teach.
I loved how engaging he was.
My favorite part was definitely the breakout session.
It was just so relevant to the things that we're experiencing today.
You must attend this conference. This is the best conference I think I've ever been to.
Join us on Saturday, March 2nd for a day filled to engage, empower, and inspire you. The day includes keynote presentation, breakout sessions, and so much more. Tickets are $35. Log on to wjct.org/teach for more information.
Discover new music at the Electro Lounge Monday through Saturday nights at 9, only on 89.9 FM. We've got your chill. Tune in and enjoy fresh music from around the world.
Welcome back. Well, the new WJCT podcast, What It's Like, has officially debuted. Here's a little bit of one episode.
I guess one of the lasting impacts that I have is that I took a bunch of really, I took a bunch of kids into a war zone. Mm. You, I, and everybody else was asked to do something that actually should never be asked of anybody.
That is a podcast where Army veterans David and Adam, who fought in Iraq, talk about their regrets and the scars of war. What It's Like explores what it's like for people who undergo a variety of different experiences. Host and producer Lindsay Kilbride is here with more. Good morning.
Good morning, Melissa. Thanks for having me on.
Thank you. And so these podcast ideas developed out of the amazing story archiving project StoryCorps, which came to Jacksonville recently and archived local people's stories in the Library of Congress. How did the podcast develop out of that?
Yeah, so StoryCorps came here, and I think that we had maybe, I tried to figure it out, it was about 100 hours of conversation. So it's 45-minute conversations between people, and I listened through a lot of them. I listened to a little bit of all of them, but I really listened through a lot of them. This was a lot of time. And then I just decided that, well, we had these really great stories, but some of them weren't a complete story in and of itself, right? So sometimes people talk to each other and they already have some of the background information, and it kind of leaves you asking, well, you know, why do you have this type of relationship? Like, why, how did you get to this point? So it's sort of the backstory, finding out why did this conversation have to happen? And so that's kind of how the podcast formed. So it's 8 episodes and they're all completely different, but they all focus on these issues or subjects that people don't really talk about publicly. So for instance, this one right here, they talked about war, and they were very candid and very honest about what war is like. And so we have David was the one speaking, and he's a little bit older. He was the sergeant. And then we had Adam, who was he was 19 when he joined the Army, just about 3 months before 9/11. And so, you know, there was a lot of our conversation focused on, did you want to be deployed? Because he didn't join in a time. He joined during a peacetime. So of course he was going to serve his country, but he wasn't one of the ones who joined because of 9/11. So, you know, it was very interesting hearing their perspective.
And let's listen to a little bit more of this one.
Do you ever worry that you carry this with you, that it's going to impact, you know, your relationships?
I already know that night I was saying things and I was doing things that night that I already know our friends they won't ever see me the same way ever again. I'm afraid that my daughters, one of the biggest things that I'm afraid of is to have something like that happen and they're actually around me. After that happened, I can tell you the next morning, somebody mentioned to them that, you know, be careful around daddy. You know, daddy wasn't himself last night. They were saying, make sure when you tap him, make sure you say, I'm Tessa or I'm Cecily. And I heard them saying that. It hurt me. It hurt my heart.
And so that, wow, that piece was right after he talked a lot of, about a recent PTSD attack, one of the worst ones he's ever had, which happened on New Year's as a result of fireworks, which we hear about all the time. But it was very eye-opening for me to actually hear, you know, him kind of detail how it felt and how he didn't know where he was. And they actually had to call David, his sergeant, on the phone and have him talk him down. He had to talk to him as if they were in the platoon again. They were using the same sort of terminology, like they were right there at that battle. And so they also talk a lot about a very specific battle, that is the source of his PTSD. And so I was really lucky and I felt very privileged to have these two veterans talk to me about what their war experience was like, because I don't really feel like anyone has the authority to ask about that, but they were very willing to open up about
that. To share that. Mm-hmm. And as I look through all of the other episodes, everyone you've talked to is going through a real challenge. You talked to a young married couple about what it's like to experience depression, which the husband says is a bit of a taboo topic among African Americans. Mm-hmm. You talked to someone with an intellectual disability, someone in town who has been an undocumented immigrant and fears being deported. You talked to a family who escaped the Khmer Rouge in Cambodia and still struggles with those scars and those horrible memories. And so, you know, all of these are local people who have really endured a horrible crisis or a really difficult life challenge.
Sure. And I know this sounds like a huge downer, but I think you'll find in the episodes that you know, people find the good out of things. People find the strength in some of these situations. So they're not all, they don't end on a, they're not tied up in a bow, which life isn't, right? But they're very honest and it is life. And so I think you'll just find a sense of understanding through the episodes, which I think is like the most important part, which is that maybe this is a tiny way of bridging divides. Maybe this is a way of starting a conversation. Maybe this is, you know, you've never spoken to an undocumented immigrant or you don't know much about the Khmer Rouge. And this, I think, can really help you understand that these people are living around us every single day.
And you can get the What It's Like podcast on our website at wjct.org/ podcasts.
Yes.
But wherever you get your podcasts.
Yes. I want to encourage people to subscribe wherever they get their podcasts. We have it on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Spotify, Stitcher, TuneIn, Overcast, Podbean. And so right now, if you are not in your car, subscribe. You can go ahead and subscribe just to have it there. So maybe tomorrow morning when you're getting ready, you can go ahead and listen.
Do that. It's What It's Like. And our new host and producer, Lindsay Kilbride, has more to come. So thanks, Lindsay.
Thank you.
And in a moment, Culpepper on that wild finish at the Daytona 500. Did you watch? He'll take us down to the race course and have some other sports news and notes right after this.
The Players' Championship moves to March. The drama unfolds on the Island Green March 12th through the 17th, with country artist John Party performing during Military Appreciation Day on Tuesday, March 12th. Tickets and parking today at theplayers.com.
Florida Prepaid. For 30 years, Florida Prepaid has been helping Florida families save for college. There are college plans for every budget, and prepaid plans are guaranteed by the state of Florida. Open enrollment ends April 30th. Florida Prepaid. Starting is believing.
This year is the 50th anniversary of the Apollo 11 moon landing. I'm Ben Brotmarkle, and coming up on Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society, we'll have the second in a series of reports commemorating this milestone event in human history. We'll discuss Florida homes from the 1920s and the Seminole and Miccosukee constitutions. That's Florida Frontiers, Monday evening at 6:30 on 89.9 WJCT.
A look at the housing market and problems therein.
Student loans really are responsible for about 20% of the reason why millennials are buying homes as much as their predecessors.
I'm Kimberly Adams. Also, some solutions. That's next time on Marketplace.
Weeknights at 6 on 89.9 WJCT.
Amazon isn't America's biggest company, but is it our most influential? It has the power to shape our economy, our shopping habits, even our diet. But it's not welcome everywhere. And it's one of the new big firms being looked at for possible antitrust violations. The United States of Amazon, that's next time on 1A.
Today at 10 on 89.9 WJCT.
Sports Wrap-Up with Cole Pepper is sponsored by Black Sheep, Orsay, and Bellwether Restaurants.
Welcome back. Well, finally this hour, it was a wild finish at the Daytona 500.
I'm a pepper, he's a pepper, she's a pepper, we're a pepper, wouldn't you like to be a pepper too?
All the way to the end of this race, Cole Pepper says, and then, you know it, the wrecks began.
Yeah, it was one of those fairly docile races, by and large, by Daytona standards, until the final 10 laps, then... The wrecks began, three of them in the final 10 laps, including one that took out 18 cars. In fact, there were only 14 cars out of 40 that finished on the final lap. Less than half of the cars that started finished the race.
Jeez.
Only 19 were even running at the end. And in the end, it was Denny Hamlin, the 2016 champion, winning for the second time. Hamlin races for Joe Gibbs Racing. Joe Gibbs, the former Washington Redskins head coach, his son, J.D. Gibbs, passed away last month. J.D. ran the team and recruited Hamlin to the team. J.D.'s favorite number was 11, which was the number on Hamlin's car. His car also included a J.D. Gibbs sticker. There were a lot of synergies there with Hamlin winning for the second time. Joe Gibbs called it the most special night of his sports life.
Wow.
And that's a guy who won three Super Bowls as a head coach. Right. So you can imagine how powerful that moment was for Joe Gibbs. And for Hamlin, it was a remarkable ending to what was a long night.
I never would have envisioned this. This is on another level. I mean, to have two Daytona 500s just as a... It's not even remotely in my mind right now that we've got two of them.
All right, so the other thing to note about Daytona was it is the that race was the last race to be run with restrictor plates. This is the way that NASCAR utilizes some technology to limit the speeds.
Limit the speeds, okay.
At the super speedways. After this, they're going to change the technology that they're going to utilize, and the hope is that there will be more passing for the lead and fewer big wrecks, making more interesting and exciting races, and you would hope safer races.
Safer. But you know, it's something I guess people don't want to say out loud. Half the fan interest is in a macabre sort of way, hoping to see the wrecks.
Yeah, I mean, that's always been part of, you know, NASCAR's legacy is that guys are aggressive. And, you know, listen, if you enjoy auto racing, you like that aggressive driving style that leads to some of these things. They have done a remarkable job of increasing safety in those cars over the years. And sometimes it's the technology in terms of, you know, the cages or the way the cars are put together. This is just another step in that direction. And if it has the intended impact of having more interesting races, then I think everybody's going to be happy.
Right. Okay. Now let's move on and talk about the sports calendar in Jacksonville in March. You, Cole Pepper, are going to be a very busy man. It's by no means an off season for you in terms of sports, because the Gate River Run is coming up, the Players Championship, and March Madness.
Yeah, and I know we're here on February the 18th, and so we've still got 10 days left in this month, but I started looking ahead to what was coming up, and that's exactly right. The Gate River Run is March the 9th.
the National Championship 15K and the largest race in Jacksonville. The players moving to March now, March 14th through 17th, and then March Madness in Jacksonville. The NCAA basketball tournament, March 21st and 23rd. So it's going to be a very busy month of March. It may make May a little sleepier than we're used to with the move from May with the players. But certainly with the March Madness coming here as well, it throws another layer on top of everything. And if the Gators are going to get into March Madness, they're going to have to get things going in the right direction. They don't have much margin for error at this point. Two straight wins, but with 14 victories and six games left on the regular season schedule, Florida might have to win out and then do something in the SEC tournament to qualify for the big dance. FSU, on the other hand, looking good. They picked up their 20th win over the weekend. They will make it in. The question is, what seed will they have, and could they potentially be one of the top seeds here in Jacksonville?
Now, let me ask you about the Gate River Run. Will you, Cole Pepper, be tackling the Green Monster this year, the Hart Bridge?
I will not. I'll be broadcasting it on Channel 4. We'll have live coverage of the Gate River Run. But over the weekend, a number of runners had the chance to do just that and climb Mount, Hart Bridge, and run over it. It's a rare opportunity. They shut down the bridge for a couple hours, and a lot of runners were able to run, go over the bridge. One of the benefits there was that it was treated as a fundraiser for Marathon High, an organization that gets at-risk kids up and moving and running, and they get sort of their victory lap at the Gate River Run, and so we'll see how that plays out on March 9th. We'll have more on that race as we get closer.
Awesome. And last but not least, Florida State baseball coming to town.
Yeah, and it's notable in particular because this is the last year as the head coach at FSU for Mike Martin, who's retiring after the season. Tomorrow's game is one of two scheduled visits to Jacksonville for FSU this year. They'll also be in town to face Florida on March the 26th. Going to be interesting to hear from the man known as 11 to reflect on what he has been doing all these years and how this last season is impacting him and where he is with the Seminoles baseball program.
Excellent. He's the hardest working man in the sports business, Cole Pepper. Follow him on Twitter at Cole Pepper. Listen to him on our show every Monday morning. Watch him every night on our news partner, Channel 4. Always good to see you, Cole.
Thanks, Melissa.
Thank you. And that's our show. Our producer is Heather Schatz. Michelle Corum is our director. Send questions and comments to First Coast Connect at WJCT.org. And make sure to catch our rebroadcast tonight at 8 p.m. I'm Melissa Ross. And if you're listening to that rebroadcast, keep listening for the Electro Lounge. Here this morning, though, 1A is up next. We'll be right back here again at 9 a.m. tomorrow. Have a great day.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.